Welcome to the Title League podcast. I'm your host, Kurt.
And I'm Trish.
And today we have Mike Melinchuk joining us, real estate mogul, former University of Alberta Golden Bears CIS champ, and trailblazer for basketball in Alberta. So looking forward to it.
What are we going to be talking with Mike about today, Kurt?
Really just discussing how much basketball has changed. He was in high school in the late 90s, played for the U of A Golden Bears from 2000 to 2004. Some of the guys that had come up before him, Steve Nash, Jamal McGlure. So really speaking to him about, you know, how much the game has changed from an accessibility and awareness aspect.
And I think, too, what I'd like to chat with him about, and hopefully he'll get into it on his own, is really how he made that transition from university athlete, all-star, to the world of real estate. And a lot of times when you're dealing with athletes, they're not really sure what that transition is going to look like, or what a life that has been focused entirely on a sport, how it can change, and how you can pivot in a different direction and use some of the same things that you've learned through sport and apply them into a new profession or a new path in life. So it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about that.
Yeah.
And you know, as always, we're gonna have to talk about whether our NBA season is going to resume or not, because with each passing day, I'm feeling a little less hopeful.
It is scary. With you just look at the numbers coming out of Florida. Obviously, that's where the NBA is resuming, in Florida. 11,000 cases reported today. Over 10,000 cases, 2 out of the last 3 days. So it's concerning, because more and more players are starting to pull out. There is less and less confidence around it. But we have heard from some of our guys in the Toronto Raptors, and they feel very safe and confident in the bubble.
Well, the Raptors are already all down there. So if anybody in the NBA knows what this bubble is going to feel like or what it's going to look like, it's them. It's our coaching staff and our team from the Raptors organization. So it's interesting to see. I was looking at some of the photos that were posted, and to see the mask that Coach Nurse was wearing that had the little vent on the front of it. And I don't know, we've said this so many times from the start of our podcast, these have been very strange times. And even when you get to a point where you think that there's a bit of normalcy coming back, you see the way people have had to adapt in order to do normal things in a COVID world. And that definitely was a bit shocking to see the black mask with the ventilator attached to it.
It is.
At least I think that's what it was. I don't know. You know which picture I'm talking about.
Well, there's
right?
been a lot of messages, you know, a lot on social media around Zion Williamson and his ventilator mask and all of the Bane comparisons.
Oh, that's perfect. That is actually a perfect, perfect comparison. I was trying to figure out.
Twitter world lost it.
Reminded me of. Yes. Oh my God.
You got to look at that picture. If you haven't seen it, you just got to Google Zion Williamson Bane. It is hilarious.
Okay. I'm doing that right now. Do you have any audio? Is there any audio out there of what he actually sounds like? Does he have the same Bane voice?
Oh.
Or is it just the image?
No.
It's just the visual.
It's the image. Zion looks like Bane.
Okay, I'm looking at.
Have you taken a look at some of the approved messages that the NBA players and the players union have agreed on that can be worn on jerseys?
No, I haven't. What are they saying?
So there's quite a big list. The list varies from Black Lives Matter, I Can't Breathe, Vote, Justice, Stand Up, Speak Up. The list goes on, but it is very cool, because players will be able to choose an approved message that they can wear on the back of their jersey.
I think, you know, we've talked about this too, about how to make the most impact for a movement like Black Lives Matter. And if the correct answer is to sit out and to not come and play, or if you're going to use that platform and that stage that everybody's going to be watching, how's the best way to make sure that you let people know that this is not something that has been forgotten? This is not something that was just a social media buzz for a week. This is a real life thing that impacts millions of people every day, and has long before the Black Lives Matter movement even started, not this last time, but years ago. And I think that being able to see on jerseys these messages is a great way to keep it first and foremost in people's minds.
Yeah. There's many of the sports that have resumed. You've seen it at the highest levels in soccer in Europe. Today, with the opening of Formula One, you saw the drivers come together in unity at the start of the race with anti-racism shirts on, as well as many of the drivers kneeling. So it is very, very welcoming to see that the momentum hasn't stopped worldwide. Our biggest influencers and athletes are not forgetting, and they're making a point of it.
Which really, you know, I would argue is part of their job. I think that when you've been given a stage when you've been given a spot on a world stage, even if it is for something that is not a political or a social state like movement, to use that platform is really their responsibility. So it's been very encouraging to see most everybody speak up in one way or another.
Exactly. As well, some of the headlines coming out of the NBA today are about NBA emphasizes mental health as teams await Disney bubble. Basketball will be the easy part, but we're talking about players being away from their families, some of them preparing to be there for 2.5 months. There is going to be a certain level of loneliness when you think about what they're coming from. I mean, COVID has already isolated a lot of people, but fortunately, most people have had the ability to isolate with family. So it's going to be unique to have players essentially just with their teammates 24/7. So the league is and the union are making or taking the necessary steps to have mental wellness resources available to players,
which is super important. And, you know, let's not forget, some families don't live in the cities that these athletes play in. And definitely there's away games when they're away from their families. But this is going to be the longest time without family, but also without fans. And that in and of itself, we were having a conversation the other day about the different level of impact that fans have depending on the sport. And basketball, to me, is one of the number one sport that is most impacted by the fans, because the fans are right there. The fans are on the court with you. And whether you're a home team or an away team, and whether it's a positive or a negative impact, depending on where you're playing, having those people and having that perspective, it's going to be very different. It's going to be a very different atmosphere for them.
I agree. It's going to be very unique. So I look forward to hearing Mike's perspective as a basketball fan, as a former player, and now someone in the business world that is connected to different athletes at the NBA level. Welcome to the show, Mike Melanchuk, former University of Alberta Golden Bears CIS champ. Mike, thanks for taking the time today and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited to be on.
You know, we've been chatting quite a bit prior to you jumping on today about how much the game of basketball has changed in Canada since you played. And you know, your heyday was, I believe, 2000 to 2004, right?
Yeah, that early 2000 to about 2005 was kind of when I left U of A or finished up there. So that's kind of when it was a unique transition phase at that time.
So the game has grown, you know, exponentially in this country, and I'm sure you can attest to that. So, you know, what was it like coming up high school, late 90s? Who were some of the guys that you looked up to?
Yeah, those are great questions, because there was a few key mentors and heroes and idols that we grew up with. When I was growing up, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but one of the things that was really interesting was in the late 90s and early 2000s, the CIS was a much different league at the time. There was fewer schools. There were fewer guys going to the U.S. on scholarships. Like if more than 10 guys from Canada were playing in the U.S. on an academic or athletic scholarship, that was a lot for basketball. And so in the CIS, you know, Canada West was comprised of like Calgary, Alberta, Lethbridge, UBC, Vic. It was only like 6 or 7 powerhouse teams. So if you were an all-star, a good player in Canada, you were going to one of those schools. And so growing up, some of the guys like the Greg DeVries, the Clayton Pottingers, Nick McGlisco, Scott Martell, I mean, all these, you know, Murray Cunningham, these legends that were kind of, Tally Swice was a guy I really knew. Growing up as a kid, the U of A Golden Bears were some of my greatest heroes growing up, because they were local talent. You know, the gyms would always be sold out. That was our product, you know. NBA was maybe you catch a Sunday, you know, NBC game with Jordan or something. So our TV was limited. Our internet was limited for you know, you didn't have NBA League Pass or anything like that. So your local basketball was quite different at the time. And so the Heroes were a little more local for me. As we got a little bit older into high school, you know, I started to attend like the Nike All-Canadian camps for the top 50 players in the country for high school. That's where we started to meet guys like Terrell Brandon, Steve Nash, you know, all those guys would host out in Toronto for the national camp. So you started to see a little more of that towards the end of my high school career, you know, and at that time too, we started to see more after the Steve Nash effect of him being a rare guy to go to the US and succeeding, you started to see more scouts and things come up. So we would go to some camps like in Vancouver and all across Canada, even in the US, where there were more recruits looking for Canadian prospects to go there. And so that was an interesting phase. But yeah, some of my mentors obviously were some of the local Golden Bears, Steve Nash, obviously Hero. Jordan was always kind of my guy. So those were some of the big names that grew up with kind of idolizing and mentoring.
It was a much different time. You and I are the same age, Mike, and here in Atlantic Canada with the AUS, it was, you know, very similar. It was a pipe dream. The NBA was not something that, no matter how good you were, no matter how much of a star you were at Dal, St. Mary's, it wasn't something that was necessarily you could envision yourself. And now when we look at the talent that's come out of Canada and the things that have changed with basketball, it always makes me marvel. We've talked about this on the show before, that now our kids who are in elementary, junior high, high school, they can actually see themselves. It's a viable option to go to the States or to be in the NBA. And it's not just because of the Raptors and having a team here. It's that they're being seen and the quality of player that's coming out is maybe not even any better than what was, but definitely being paid closer attention to.
I think that's such a good point. I think there were some guys before that were unbelievably talented, that almost more talented in some areas than of some kids now, but they just never got that exposure. I mean, yeah. You look at Nash. Nash had to beg to get one school just to look at his video. You know what I mean? Like that. And so when you see that, and you go back to Trisha's comment, I mean, if you're going to say guys were more talented than Nash now, I don't think that was the case. I just think that it was a different time of exposure. And I mean, Nash had to mail his VHS videos essentially down to the States. Like you were instead, it's even funny. Like I had a couple awesome clips of some game winners and buzzer beaters from back in the day, but I got to get the VHS out and do it. It's just hard. Like now, you're just,
so
you know, I
do you still have a VHS player?
Oh, just for my old tapes. Yeah. Just right. Once in a while, you gotta pull up the old highlight package.
So for context there, Mike, for people that may not know a lot about Canadian basketball, when you were playing university basketball in Canada, you said there were a few guys that went down south. We just talked about Nash begging a school to take a look at him. Today, or at the start of last year, there were over 150 Canadians playing basketball at the NCAA level. So what do you think attributes to that? Of course, there's lots, but we just talked about VHS, and now we live in a day and age of social media. How much do you think that has impacted recruiting?
I mean, I think tremendously. I mean, I work in the real estate world now, and I look at where realtors and salespeople were 15, 20 years ago. I mean, you basically opened the yellow pages and had to come by an office to look at houses. Now, I mean, if you're not 95% of deals, do them within your phone. You know, you're just looking at stuff and specs. So you look at how worlds and industries change. I think the same goes for recruiting. I mean, you can literally half the U.S. kids now in the top 50 or top 100, they got their own YouTube and Instagram channels, and they're just highlight packs every single night. And so to get that before was a lot of work. It wasn't as instant. The quality wasn't as good. So I think a lot of the work now is it's so accessible, and the recruits are so accessible via, you know, social media and stuff. It's completely changed the game. I absolutely, internet, not just Canada, but all across the world. I think it's all across the world now.
It's definitely made the world a much smaller place and made goals more attainable. You talked about real estate and doing it all on your phone. Even when you're not looking for a house, you can still be looking at houses. I just, for no reason yesterday, I just started looking at the highest listed pieces of property and houses in Nova Scotia just to see what they were.
And so exactly.
lots of oceanfront, not a lot of acreage though, unfortunately.
Exactly. that's fun. But yeah, but back in the day, I mean, in early, you would have to go to a local office and open up a binder and just look there. Like, you couldn't, where are you going to go, on your computer or your phone? You didn't have that ability. So just the speed of doing business, the speed of looking at things, recruiting. I mean, there's such a direct comparison when you think of that. So yeah, I think there's absolutely, it's just made the world faster.
Oh,
it's made
it way too fast.
I'm a bit of a novice at this too. So like, pardon my ignorance, but when you look at the shrinking of the world and how everything is sort of within our reach and doesn't matter where somebody is, when we talk about basketball, we talk about Canada basketball internationally. Are there more international players now because of that as well, like outside of Canada, US?
It's a really good question, Trish. And I think one of the things that I realized, so when after university, I went to go try out professionally in Greece and in Europe and try to play over there. And one of the things that I realized was, if you didn't have a Div 1 or NBA or something from an American, like, collegiate or professional background, you were not looked at the same way as an international player. And they were only allowed two players per team. And a lot of the fans and a lot of the organization expected to have that on your resume. So if you were from Canada, they're kind of going, well, who's this, like, Canadian kid? Like, why is he coming here? Whereas if you were able to filter maybe a scholarship to a U.S. school, even a smaller school, but Div 1 or Div 2, to have that on your resume was one of the hardest factors, besides me applying, because my family's from Europe, but like digging into the roots of trying to get a passport down there so you're not an import player. That was a huge challenge. And so guys wanted to see that on the resume. So now I think with social media, with that exposure leading to more guys getting to the US, I think the international, you know, the next step is easier because of that. And guys want to see that on your resume, that you did play Div 1 or you did play in the G League or D, whatever these leagues, you know, there's so many leagues now, but you were in an American system. I think they value that from an international level for basketball.
So do you recall, you know, 95, when we had the expansion into Toronto and Vancouver at all?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I do, for sure.
So at that time, you said, you know, you'd catch the odd NBA game on NBC on a Sunday night, Jordan. You know, the NBA was really still American. It wasn't, you know, today when you think about basketball, you think about the NBA, it's a global brand. How big was that for you as an up-and-coming player? And, you know, did you follow any of those teams? I mean, being in Western Canada, in Edmonton, you're remote from Toronto, and it's not necessarily easy to get to Vancouver as well. So what was that like, and what can you tell us about that time?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It was obviously an exciting time with the new teams. I had my Sharif Abdul-Rahim and my Damon Stoudemire, all those jerseys. So, I was always funny because as a kid in junior high and high school, if you won MVP at basketball camps, they'd usually toss you a Raptors or a Grizzlies jersey. So I was always – you couldn't afford to buy one, so you try to win one at a camp or something. So I had my stack of Raptors and Grizzlies jerseys. It was difficult as a young kid without a budget to be able to fly out to the cities to watch those games. But when they did come through Edmonton, we always tried to get like a courtside or shoot hoops at halftime, like when it would come through the city, when it would roll through. Now it's as a little more, you know, seasoned kind of business professional, like, I go to all the NBA finals. I like to go, you know, when I'm in New York, or watch LeBron in Brooklyn courtside, like that kind of stuff. I try to always do when I can now, even when I'm with work or traveling in the US, I always catch games like the best you can. So, but budget is obviously not as big a concern when you're a kid. And even back then, it wasn't like to fly, to stay, to book tickets. It's so much easier now with the way the world is, but that was an interesting time that, it definitely put basketball on the map, but it was slower. It was still more like a basketball click thing. Like, there were people that still weren't catching on. And the fact it didn't survive in Vancouver to me is just such a tragedy, because I actually thought it would have survived at first in Vancouver over Toronto, especially with the Pacific Rim and the Asian Chinese love basketball. And to have that kind of fall apart, I felt, maybe if we got Yao Ming or something there, it would have been different, you know, like at that time. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say a bit of a wasted opportunity.
Yeah, and I just like it's people love basketball in Vancouver. BC is such a powerhouse for b-ball. And so it was was really disappointed to see the Grizzlies leave. And I don't know if it was bad management or organizational stuff from the top, but that looking back, there's no way that like Vancouver's in, you know, Memphis, even Memphis versus Vancouver. I mean, Vancouver's just like one of the best cities in the world, hands down, and they should have an NBA team. And so that's how I see it. And I was really sad to see them go.
You know, it's interesting because for people who are not Canadian, you don't realize how vast this country is. So as a kid in 95, 96, 97, you know, I'm in Halifax. I'm not going to Toronto, and I'm definitely not going to Vancouver to watch an NBA game. This is not, it's a very different, you know, you can't get in the car. I mean, you could get in the car and drive to Toronto, but that's just not necessarily something that we would do. So you talked about budget, and yes, as an adult, it's easier to access these things, but I think it's easier for kids these days to access these things. I think that even taking it away from, internet perspective or a digital perspective and having the all access to NBA passes and having, you know, 150 channels that you can watch sports on, just the action of going to an NBA game is something that's a little bit more attainable no matter where you're living in the country, and going to the States and doing it as well is something that's a little bit more attainable. But do you think that we should have a second basketball team?
Absolutely. I mean, it's all about business. It's all let's not kid ourselves. The numbers have to work. But to me, you know, Vancouver is the city that could and should make that work. In my perspective, I mean, it's those cities should be supported with enough infrastructure and that to do it. I just don't know if it was a management issue or what. I absolutely think there should be two teams because East and West is so vast. It's so far. I mean, it's faster to fly to LA than to Toronto for us, right? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. So from that perspective, we're from LA to New York, it's a long way. And so it's like Vancouver to Halifax. It's we're a big country. And so I think to have that East and West would be awesome. You saw it when the Raptors made their run, how everyone was just loving it and just jumping on board. And so I think you see how passionate people are towards the game. You know, to me, I absolutely think there should be or could be a second team for sure.
I agree. And, you know, Adam Silver has made it pretty known. His mom lives in Vancouver. He gets out there quite a bit. And it's just about timing. It makes sense to have a team there. It makes sense to have a team in Seattle. There needs to be more teams in the Northwest. It's just now doesn't make sense economically. And with what the world's going through now during a global pandemic, sports are different as we're seeing that right now with the return of the NBA coming up in a few weeks. So I think the next few years are going to be very interesting because a lot of those plans may not be destroyed, but I think a lot of them have been altered and will change, and maybe we'll see other markets fold. It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, what I think is also interesting about that, I mean, my background was a chartered accountant, so I'm a numbers guy. Like, I studied school, did my master's in accounting, so I love numbers. I love business and balance sheets and economic forecasts. And even how collective bargaining agreements, that was something I studied in my master's degree. Like, I love to see that part of it, the negotiations, the players' unions. There could be some major overhauls after COVID. I mean, you talk NFL, everyone's getting pumped. I don't know if there's going to be a season. I mean, the NFL is the toughest sport to play. So you look at that aspect of it too. It's going, it could be drastically different. If the NBA can't save this season, I mean, salaries and expansion, I mean, I don't even think they'll discuss that for a few years.
So why do you think players are going back to play? Your honest opinion.
They have to play for their own well-being. Their salaries would get, I don't know what the numbers would be, but they would get such a cut moving forward. A lot of them are you know, set to sign huge renegotiations in the next 2 to 3 years. And if they do not fulfill their TV obligations, there is massive repercussions. They'd have to tear up the CBA. And so I think they'd have to redo collective bargaining agreements, revenue sharing, the whole bit again would be all that they worked for to build the brand so big. I think it would be devastating to them. And so I think there's a couple of things. I think number one is guys are so competitive. They do want to win, and they do want to maintain that level of, you know, the lifestyle that they're able to achieve. They're worth a certain amount. And number two, I think when they came together, I think the platform for them to discuss Black Lives Matter, to discuss their social issues is more powerful than staying at home. I truly believe like every night you'll see those guys on TV. I think it's, they should be playing to discuss those issues personally. I think you're going to get way more, you're going to get way more pressed there than staying at home. I think so.
I agree with you completely, but you know, we're seeing more and more players saying that they don't want to play and that they're not going to play. And then we look at the numbers in relation to COVID in Florida that are going up exponentially every single day. And I don't know, I said earlier, Kurt and I were talking before you jumped on, and I am feeling less confident that this is going to, that the season is going to resume. So a question though is who has to bear the brunt of that? So if it's COVID related and the season doesn't start, who's responsible? And who, and but if it's players choosing not to come and that makes it more difficult for them to resume a season, then is it those players that are held accountable? Is it the circumstances that are held, like the, in the bigger picture of who's going to be responsible if this season doesn't resume?
Yeah, really, really intense and strong question. I don't like to watch real news. I like sports news. I find the real news is too upsetting, and I don't really enjoy it. But I do watch sports media not relentlessly every day. So for me, sports news is kind of my life. But I've been watching a lot of this, and I've been seeing the reaction. And you know, I'm not sure if it's swayed in the last week or two, but it seemed like in the last few weeks, it was like 90-95-5 guys wanted to play versus not play. But I think it shifted a little bit in the last week or two. You know, I was talking with one of my best friends in Los Angeles last night. I have a few friends across the states. And to see how people are acting and behaving during this time, it's really, really disappointing that I feel the country over there is so divided. People just don't care anymore. It's really, really disappointing. Look at Los Angeles, people launching the amount of fireworks and out and about and parties. It's just, it's at a point now where I don't know who's going to take this and grasp. In my opinion, I think the bubble is still the safest place you can be in the US. I mean, if you're there, I mean, it's the amount of medical investment and things that they've put into there. I think it's the safest place to be, quite honestly. Those guys will fly in private jets. They'll get there once they're there. They'll be in their quarantine. I think getting their families and things out is the challenge. But to answer your question of who will bear the brunt, I think players and owners will have to bear the brunt. You have to look at the business side of everything. And this is the hard part about life. And one of the challenges with like governments versus businesses is if you run out of money in a business, then you just can't pay your employees. At some point, you have to cut the line, or you go out of business. And so I think there has to be management and players renegotiating a brand new collective bargaining agreement. They'll have to, if TV revenues are down and they can't achieve that, it will greatly impact. Like they're talking CFL might have to shut down. Like the CFL might go bankrupt. And there's a lot of leagues that don't, you know, so I think it has to be a player and owner responsibility, because it can't just fall on the players or the owners, because you kind of need each other in it. Good employees, good ownership, but it's a huge challenge. And nobody knows the answer just yet.
And Mike, you hit the nail on the head there. It is economics 101. Even if the season continues, the CBA is going to change drastically, because if revenue's not there, you can't pay employees. Owners and players are going to have to come to the table. It is going to be difficult. Even guys that are on big contracts, I can see those contracts being changed and reduced. I strongly believe that it's going to be a restart for everybody. And that's unfortunate, but we're in a time right now where if you cannot afford to move forward financially, then it's either park it, suspend it, close it, or find a way to continue. So it is actually just very, in a way, just sad.
Yes, forgive me if this is a dumb question, but is there any insurance? Is there any, like, is there not a contingency somewhere on these teams or in these leagues? Not that you would think that a pandemic would happen, but if for some reason a season would have to be suspended or canceled entirely, isn't there anything that's
there's
a bit
the,
of a safety net?
Force majeure, I forget the terminology, but
yes. There is insurance to some point, which is a great point, Trish. But the one thing I'll tell you, it's like when a country gets hit by a flood, there's insurance up to a point that the insurance company can pay out the claims until they're like, screw it, we're done. We can't afford this claim. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if it would be so astronomical that they would just shut it down, in a sense to be like, well, we can't pay it out, right? The insurance company is only as good as your premiums allow you to pay until there's nothing left. And so right. I don't know if this would be so great that insurance wouldn't even have the, you know, Hopefully, yes. There's insurance for the players that if this happens, to Kurt's point about, you know, if that does happen, they are protected if force majeure or something in the law where it's an act of God or something, or there's something that creates the ability that they can't play, they are insured. But if the league itself, if you go one step beyond, if the economics of the leagues don't start to make sense, I don't know if there's insurance for that part of it. I'm not 100%.
One of the headlines coming out of the NBA today was the NBA's reopening is a good sign for the U.S. economy because it generates just so much revenue, jobs. So, you know, there's good and bad. And I think, you know, in every single business, there's going to be case studies to come, after the fact of what, you know, the coronavirus did to the world. It is, you know, in my opinion, in this short period of time that we've been through it already, it is the greatest depression in the last century.
Yeah, it's, and I think I run two different businesses, or I'm involved with two different businesses at home. I got, you know, 20 people in one. We have, you know, another 8 to 10 people in the other. And trying to maneuver through this is so interesting. And trying to find ways to be efficient, ways to be productive and profitable moving forward is the greatest challenge. I still think the unknown is yet to come. I mean, there's still so much to come. I think it's not that old. It's only like, in my, you know, half a few months. In my opinion, it's not even a year old. It's half a year. And March when it hit, March, April, wasn't that long ago. And so I think the repercussions, the long-term repercussions, people have yet to see. And it will be really interesting to see the dynamics of even just look at airlines, look at flights, look at sports. It's just like, you honestly think NFL is going to start? I don't think NFL can start. There's no real plan. And the bubbles are all great, but you can't have a regular season in a bubble. It just doesn't make it just impossible.
I don't even think the NFL was taking this seriously to begin with, because they were in off season and there were months where it didn't seem like anything was being planned, where they were just going about their business of contracts and thinking, oh yeah, you know, by the time our season rolls around, this is going to be over and we can just resume as if nothing had happened. And I question that, because somebody in the upper levels should have had some foresight of, maybe we should figure out if this is the case and we're still looking at this from 2 months, 3 months, 4 months down the road, what are we going to do or how are we going to do it? And that hasn't really seemed to be the case.
Mm-hmm. I still, in my heart of hearts, I still think NBA will go ahead. I really do. I still think they'll play. I think it will be but towards next season and regular seasons, I don't know about that. I'm more confident about them going in the bubble to play. I really think they will. I think the top guys to want to go will go. I don't see them backing out. I think it's too critical to them and the league. I don't know. I think it's, like you said, I think it's trying to send a message that, you know, it's really important for the U.S. You know, just I think morally, just they need to have that some such a business driven country, they need to see something. It gives a bit of hope, and I think the NBA is going to be the one to do it. And usually Adam Silver seems to be the most in tune socially with the world and that. But but the country as itself, I mean, I have friends all over the U.S. There's a lot of people they just don't care anymore. Then it's really upsetting. It's just like, oh, if it happens, it happens, right? So it's really.
Well, we're it's just a few weeks away.
That opens up a positive of, you said the top guys are going to go, but you know, you need more than the top guys to field teams. And so one of the positives that I see is that this is also going to possibly be an opportunity for those players that don't get a lot of court time or are in the G League and are going to have the ability to be on eyes watching them more closely and really be able to step up and show what they've got. So I think that could be one of the most positive things that come out of this bubble scenario.
Mm-hmm.
On a brighter note, just moving forward, talking about, you know, Canadian basketball, how much it's grown. We've been impacted this year. There's no Olympics this summer, so we're looking forward to Tokyo 2021. Have you been following the Canadian team at all, Mike? And this will be potentially the first time ever that Team Canada puts out a all NBA roster. So what are your thoughts on that?
It's a great question, man. And I followed Canada basketball super close since for many years, but Nash kind of got everybody interested again many years ago. I've been really disappointed with Canada basketball the last, you know, since Nash stepped away. I felt so let down that we couldn't qualify after the last one. I just felt like we lost to an old senior men's team out of the country in the South, but watching that last qualifier, like a bunch of older guys that play in the local league. We got NBA stars that just, I think it exposed part of the NBA game versus international game again. Guys just play a little different. The NBA league is a bit different, especially for the bigger post guys. I think it exposed some of our older, guys that we've relied on to be a bit of, you know, the bangers and that played in the NBA. But I don't know. There was no excuse that Canada should not be making that Olympic team without East. I mean, we have a couple number one draft picks. Guys should be there. I think a lot of NBA guys do want to play for the most part. I think they need some quality young leaders on that team. I think they need the new NBA, not the older NBA guys, Canadian guys. They need as much of that young blood as they can.
Well, they faced a lot of criticism, obviously, when they lost to the initial qualifier, and then they put out a team that played and won to get the wild card berth. And now since that, you've seen, late last year into early this year, a lot of guys came out and said, you know, they're going to play from Shea to Nikhil, Jamal Murray. There are a lot of guys, RJ as well. So that commitment is nice. And obviously, we want to see it come to fruition. But if we, you know, we've got great young talent, and there's never been a better time for us to go out and show that, you know, we can win a medal.
Absolutely. I think Jamal is the key. I think you saw him with the juniors, you know, when they beat the US. I think he is the key for that young talent to kind of lead. I think he's such a superstar that he's got to be the guy to, it's like that Nash, you need that point guard. You need that guy to set the tone and kind of guide them, especially at that international game. You get less time to play, less time to practice. You need that leader. And I think Jamal Murray is the guy. I really do. I've always been a huge, huge fan. And you saw what he did with the junior programs coming up. And so I hope he can play. I hope he can stay healthy. I know his body's been a little bit banged up the last year or two. I watched him play in Denver a couple of times this year, which was awesome. But I think he's critical for them. But like you said, the young talent has to come in with that kind of Nash mentality where they want to play. You can't force guys to play. I felt the Wiggins and I felt they didn't really want to be there. I felt they did just to be there. And I felt that attitude has to go, because you'll never win it. You'll never win with that mentality.
I agree. And, you know, it makes a difference. There's been some changes. We've got Nick Nurse that's going to lead the bench. And, you know, when you've got a guy like Coach Nick Nurse, that makes a big difference. And you look at the fact that it's not World Cup, we're talking Olympics. You look at the U.S. teams that have won, from the Dream Team to, you know, I just saw a video the other day of Kobe and LeBron. If you're a Canadian basketball player, you've watched that growing up. There's a lot that, you know, your inner drive to compete. Why would you not want to go and compete at the highest level against a U.S. team that has got all NBA guys on it? So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be exciting, and I think Coach Nurse will do a heck of a job.
I think so too. No, I think that's a great leader to have behind that. I think guys will want to play knowing who's at the bench as well. That was always such a big thing with Nash and Triano. With their origin was, they had to have that good coach that guys wanted to play for as well. I think that's really key.
Like I want to change the topic a little bit and get more into a personal perspective of how you transitioned away from sport or away from basketball. You know, you said you're a numbers guy, and that's always been a part of your life on top of basketball. But how difficult was it for you after university to kind of put aside your athlete hat and move into a new life and a new direction for your career?
That's a great question. I tried to extend my career a little bit beyond university into playing professional in Europe. I unfortunately had a really, really bad car accident that made me stop. And it ended up being a blessing, but I was at a point where I just physically couldn't do it. And so I needed that year, 2 years, just to give my body a rest after it. And so it forced me to go back to school, finish my master's at the U of S. I struggled a lot when I went into my first job. I was a chartered accountant working at KPMG, a big firm. And I felt, you know, that the aspect of sports was in teams was, I felt a little bit trapped in the corporate setting. Luckily, I was able to, you know, put in my time. Like I tell a lot of young guys I mentor, you have to try as many things as you can when you're young, because you'll know what you like and don't like, and you have to fail, and you have to see what's good and what's bad. And what that did is it opened up the ability to. I had a friend ask me to join him on a real estate team, and I never in my life thought of something that's the way that I would go with it. But what it quickly did is it ignited my passion again for people and teams, and to be the best in sports, you have to have a level of independence where you're in the gym shooting hoops by yourself. And I think I took that part of it into owning my own business and creating my own team from a real estate perspective, and then as well as the other company we own a marketing and research firm as well, my other partners. And so it grew my mind it really inspired me again to work with people and to have the same kind of mentality as I did with sports into a sales team or small business. And so I think sports really, really prepped me for that. It was a seamless transition. It also was amazing to go back and realize how many friends and associates and colleagues and coaches that you meet through sports that end up being assets to you in life and in business. And that was where I really started to realize that through running my own business, especially a sales firm and a sales company, that's where a lot of it started to come back. And so that transition, it was difficult after, because I was put in a corporate setting that, you know, you're so used to kind of being free and traveling and playing sports. And then all of a sudden it's like 9 to 5, 8 to 5. That was a really difficult 2-3 years for me to figure out. But like sports, you have to struggle to realize what's, what you need. Because if everything in life is given, like sports, if you're always the best from early on, if you don't have to work for it, you'll never be that great. You have to suffer and you have to go through the hard times to get there. And so that's just, that was my experience.
How old were you, or what point in your career did you realize that you were going to have another option away from sports or away from basketball? How far in advance did you plan for that, or when did it become a reality?
I started to feel it as my, what junior high, I had all the aspects, my aspirations to go pro, to be the best I could be, was at an all-time high. I mean, I think in grade 9, I was putting up like 69, 70 a game in grade 9, dunking on guys. It was like getting recruited out of grade 9 by some coaches to go to US. I thought I could be that guy. High school, you still had that dream. Yeah. As you get into university, you mature. I mean, when you're 15 versus 20, it's a big jump, right? And so when I started to hit that level of like university, that I realized you start to realize the odds of what it takes. And, looking back, yeah, it probably was in that freshman year of university. You kind of start to realize that life will take it. Now, there's still the option to go pro. There's still those dreams were alive. But I think probably around that 20, 19, 20 years old, I started to realize that it would become incredibly difficult to do that. And to be honest, like, it's NBA guys are just the most rare elite talents. Like it's just so unbelievably incredible and hard to find, that you start to look at the numbers and that of what it takes. And it's you can't always control that part of it. But it did create a sense, though, that it gave me some clarity to move on a little bit and accept that. But it also made me appreciate that I had the opportunity from many schools to go Div 1 and play in the U.S. at a time when it was really hard. But I was really happy that I decided at the time to stay at U of A. We won a national championship. We were always contenders, locally in business after the fact. It just set me up for such a good life after. I mean, my involvement with people and friends and colleagues and teammates, it was the ultimate transition. And I give a lot of guys like a second opinion when I'm like, yeah, you can go play in Delta, Missouri or Mississippi, like in one of these little schools with, I'm like, we had 3,000-4,000 people watching every night, and we were their biggest fans, and I had job offers, coming out of the woodworks after university because people knew us. They were close to us. They grew up watching. And Canadian cities and Canadian universities, when we played, it was a bit different because, like, of our national championship team, I think of our top seven or eight players, like, at least probably five of the seven guys were from the city. Now I look at a lot of the teams, it's like they got guys from the States coming to Canada. Yeah. Like, it's like reverse. It's totally weird. Like, I got guys from Las Vegas playing at U of A. It's like, what the heck? This is crazy. So
it's so different. And it's such a different mentality within our major cities in Canada. So it's changed. It has changed a bit. But I remember I have family in the States. And so when I was growing up, you know, I'm from Halifax. I'm going to university at Dalhousie. I'm here. I'm staying in Halifax. I have like a number of them to choose from. And in the States, it's a rite of passage almost that you would never go to a state school. You would never go to a college in the city that you grew up in. It's always you go away and you go to like the most random colleges, like across the country. But that was a rite of passage for them. And for us, yeah, you're in Calgary, you're in Vancouver, you're in Edmonton, you're in Toronto, you're in the major cities in Canada. We have phenomenal universities and you stay and you play at home. And it's almost as if it's our rite of passage to stay and want to be a part of our home schools and our hometowns. And yeah, that's really, and I think that we might be one of the last sort of generations or age groups where that really came into play, that it was just never questioned that you were going to go. I was never going to go to school in Vancouver. I was never going to go to Toronto or to Waterloo, or I was always going to go to school in Halifax, at least for an undergraduate degree. After that, maybe, but it was not a part of the way that we were brought up.
For sure. No, it's funny. I one of the beautiful things about well, and when I was in, before I committed to UVA, I mean, every school in Canada, I pretty much talked to, I looked around, and it just made sense to stay local, for me. And looking back, I was really happy that I did. But Halifax was always we went to the final eights every year, all 5 years I was there. So it's always, Halifax has a special place in my heart. That as a Canadian basketball player, you always kind of, you grew up watching those games on TSN, and you always wanted to be in the final eights, you know? And so it was such a big thing for us growing up that, you know, you always opened against St. Mary's or FSU. Yeah. We always got a tough draw playing in front of 15,000 sold out people. We're like, hey, we're the one seed, we're the two seed. Why are we playing like a home game? But I loved that part of it and getting out there. I think that Halifax, it was such a staple for all people to go. It was such a special place to me, especially for nationals. We loved it.
I love hearing that. Definitely a part of my book growing up. Finally, it was always the city would just be a buzz. There would it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Most for definitely. Sure. I think, you know, this year they took nationals to Ottawa. It's coming back to Halifax next year. So I'm looking forward to it. Mike, you know, you're an entrepreneur. You founded your real estate group in 2012. In closing, what advice or what would you tell our listeners, whether they are former athletes or in the entrepreneurial world, what has attributed to your success in the last 8 years in building a company?
That's another awesome question, Kurt. A neat stat, as of this year, like my team and I will have hit over $1 billion in sales locally in the last decade, which is a huge accomplishment when our average sales is like $250,000. So we're going to do over $1 billion worth of sales in a smaller market, right? And that was, my parents were in real estate. I didn't have anybody help me with anything. It was self-made for the last, I've been in the business now almost 14 years. And so I don't like to call myself a salesperson. I think of more myself as someone that helps people, a relationship consultant in a way. But the thing that I tell a lot of young guys are to give advice, whether you're an entrepreneur, whether you're looking for any career outside of basketball, there's a few values, and I don't have them written down, but I'll try to, I have this discussion with a lot of people. There's a few traits, and I'll kind of list them, that I, obviously hard work. I know it's cliche, but you know, it doesn't matter if people are watching. I'm a total Nighthawk. If you need me at 3 a.m., I'm always at the office. So I've never taken a day off in 14 years. As weird as it sounds, I travel the world, I do a lot of things, but I've never disconnected from my business in 14 years. I don't ever feel like it's work. I just feel like it's a lot of time. But I tell people, you can't be afraid to try everything. You have to do it when you're younger. No families, no kids, no commitments. You can make mistakes. I had other businesses and restaurants. I lost everything a couple of times, and you have to restart. It's always going to be okay. I tell people, I'm like, it gets harder to try as you get a little more mature. So the thing I tell younger people is don't be afraid to experience whatever you can. And there, you have to give it your all, because some people think they work hard, but it's really not enough. You have to become super uncomfortable with pushing yourself to a limit. And I was lucky. My father was, my parents were both teachers, and so they pushed us in different ways. Mom heavily from the academic side, dad heavily from an athletic side. But it was really uncomfortable. And it was basketball and sports, was whether it was volleyball, track and field, baseball, football. We played them all, and we were always provincial champs in whatever sport we played. It was just it's an attitude that you develop when you're young. And I'd also tell people, you surround yourself with people who push you to be better. I know my best friends and I, like, it's the same thing with my business. I try to bring in people that inspire. I think being loyal, being honest, being ethical, not being afraid to share your problems with people, those are traits that you can't replace. There's a lot of talented people that aren't loyal. They do not last with me. They do not survive with my team. I'll take a loyal guy that's a 60% all around and honest, and we'll have much more success than 100% hardworking, smart guy that isn't loyal or isn't honest or can't be. You know, that is a key part of growing an industry, that people pick up on that. One of my favorite professors from university, one of the things he always taught me, and I did a PhD with him about, I was going to do a PhD with him on the side, but I ended up doing my master's. But he taught me about collective bargaining in sports and business negotiations and how it affects the world. And he always says, you know, you look at the U.S., you look at Canada, you look at the world we're in, collective or a collaborative negotiating where all parties win, you win, I win. The world works so much better when that happens. The power bargainers, you know, the one guy gets all, one country gets all the rest, it ends up creating incredible dissension amongst yourself, your business. And so if I always tell people, there's one thing you can study how to, you know, effectively do business negotiations and life negotiations. Want other people to succeed, like have a win-win scenario. It creates such a better environment for you and your business and your work. And those are kind of just a few of the things that I would say. That, sorry if I rambled a bit, but I just I try to get into the points that I think are necessary. But just some of my thoughts.
I love that.
Very, very true, inspirational. And I think anyone who is, you know, starting out in the entrepreneurial world or is an entrepreneur and along this journey, they can relate to that. So where can people find you? If someone's looking for someone to represent them in the market, where can we find you?
There's a couple spots. I mean, we're pretty active on Instagram. We're just the Melnichuk Group. On Facebook, I'm just Michael Melnichuk. You can find me. We have the Melnichuk Group on Facebook as well. My website, melnichukgroup.com, as well is out there. I don't know if I can put a bio or something on. I always tell people too, if anyone ever has any questions, I love helping people. You have to be willing to help people. You get so much more in return. I learned that from a lot of athletes. You meet guys like Nash, you meet some of those guys. They're always willing to teach and help go the extra mile with guys. And it's never about benefiting themselves, but you end up getting way more back, even if your intention is just to help. And so, if any guys or small business people, I get asked to do a lot of podcasts. It's funny when talk to Rohit, but I don't do a lot of them because I find a lot of guys' platforms aren't set up for the right questions. And so I love the questions that you've asked. And I think if people that really want help, they can't be afraid to ask, right? It is important. And there's, I find that the younger generations growing up, they're quite shy to ask for help. I don't know what it is, but people can't be afraid to do that. The best guys will always reach out and try to help them. So.
That's amazing. I have not to take your compliment of good questions. Now I have three really silly questions that I want to ask you that we try to end every show with. I don't want you to think too hard. Just the first thing that comes to mind. So if you were to write your biography today, what would you call it?
Dream big.
Dream big. That's a good one. If you were going to have a movie made about your life, who would be the actor to play you?
Liv Schreiber.
Oh, that is an unexpected answer.
I don't think he'd play my life, but I just love him as an actor.
Awesome.
You know what? And everyone says I look like Ralph Fiennes, so they remind my aunties in the States all tell me. So maybe we'll stay with Ralph Fiennes because we look alike. Or when I'm older, I'll look like him.
He'll play you in the advanced years version.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
And if there's one TV show, past or present, that could describe your life right now, what would it be?
I don't want to say Ray Donovan, but I love Ray Donovan. He's just top of my head. I just like obsess them, but I feel that his character, he goes through a lot of personal struggle, but you always have to take care of the ones around you. Not the bad side of him, but the good. There's usually good intentions behind the struggle. That's what right. I say. So
I love it. That's great. Thank you, Mike. We've loved having you on the show. Really appreciate you taking the time and hope that you've had a bit of fun.
I did. It's awesome. You guys, if you're anything, just let me know. I'm always happy to chat again. Thanks.
Really enjoyed it,
and
Mike.
Good luck. Good luck with the upcoming NBA. It's probably going to be a lot to talk about in the next 2-3 weeks. I'm anxiously awaiting to see what happens. So I'm sure you guys are too.
Most definitely. You have a phenomenal evening, and thanks again, Mike. Take care.